Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's useful to get some notebook, paper, and pen to take notes during the show. What we have been doing for some months now is exploring the myths about money. Our money system is not what we have been led to believe. The creation of money has been privatized or taken over by a private money cartel. Except for coins, all of our money is now created as loans advanced by private banking institutions, including the private Federal Reserve. Banks create the principal, but not the interest, to service their loans. To find the interest, new loans must continually be taken out, expanding the money supply, inflating prices, and robbing you of the value of your money. We've been specifically looking at a book called The Web of Debt, which unravels the deception and presents a clear picture of the financial abyss towards which we are heading. It then explores workable alternatives, particularly one that was tested in colonial America and is grounded in the best of American economic thought, including the writings of Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and Abraham Lincoln. It helps us to analyze and improve our own financial security, personally and nationally, and to deeply understand the cause of the problems we are personally experiencing financially. At the onset, I give an important credit because the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in this program are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of attorney, scholar, and author Ellen Brown, who has 11 books and scores of articles on debt-related matters. I highly recommend her book, The Web of Debt. You should also visit her website by the same name. You could also go to www.kruufm.com under Archives to listen to all of the shows produced on this and other debt-related topics. This particular series is under Life and Debt Web. In the last show, I ended up talking about China. Napoleon had called China a sleeping giant. "Let him sleep," Napoleon said. "If he wakes, he will shake the world." China has now awakened and is really shaking the world. The dragon has become so strong economically that it has been called the greatest threat to national security the United States faces, accounting for the greatest imbalance of any country in the U.S. trade budget deficit. This balance of trade problem is not new. The British were already complaining of it in the early 19th century. Then they discovered that exporting opium from India to China could offset their negative trade balance and give them control of China's financial system at the same time. The Chinese emperor responded by banning the opium trade after China started losing huge amounts of money to England. England then declared war, initiating the Opium Wars of 1840. The Chinese people wound up with two sets of imperial rulers, the British as well as their own. The leader of the revolution that finally overthrew 2,000 years of Chinese imperial rule was Dr. Sun Yat-sen, now revered as the father of modern China by nationalists and communists alike. Like the leaders of the Japanese Meiji Revolution of the 1860s, he was a protege of a group of American nationalists of the Lincoln-Carey faction. Sun's fundamental principles, known as the Three Principles of the People, were based on the concept presented by Lincoln in Gettysburg Address, government of the people, by the people, and for the people. Sun was educated in Hawaii, where he built up his revolutionary organization at the house of Frank Damon, the son of Reverend Samuel Damon, who had run the Hawaii delegation to the American Centennial in Philadelphia in 1876. Frank Damon provided money, support, and military training to Sun's organization, and Hawaii became its base for making a revolutionary movement in China. The Chinese Republic was proclaimed just before World War I. After Sun's death, the nationalists lost control of mainland China to the communist Chinese, who founded the People's Republic of China in 1949. But the communists retained much of the American system in creating their monetary scheme, which was a Chinese variation of Lincoln's greenback program. Before that, banknotes had been issued by a variety of private banks. After 1949, these banknotes were recalled and the renminbi, or the people's currency, became the sole legal currency issued by the People's Bank of China, a wholly government-owned bank. The United States and other Western countries imposed an embargo against China in the 1950s, blocking trade between it and most of the rest of the world except the Soviet bloc. China then adopted a Soviet-style centrally planned economy, but after 1978, it pursued an open-door policy and was transformed into a market economy. Private industry is now flourishing in China, and privatization has been creeping into its banking system as well. But it still has government-owned banks that can issue national credit for domestic development. By 2004, China was leading the world in economic productivity, growing at 9% annually. In the first quarter of 2007, its economic growth was up to a remarkable 11.1%, with retail sales climbing 15.3%. The commonly held explanation for this impressive growth is that Chinese are willing to work for what amounts to slave wages. But the starving poor of Africa, Indonesia, and Latin America are equally willing, yet their economies are languishing. Something else distinguishes China, and one key difference is its banking system. China has a government-issued currency and a system of national banks that are majority-owned by the nation. According to Wikipedia, the People's Bank of China is unusual in acting as a national bank focused on the country, not the currency. The notion of national banking, as opposed to private central banking, goes back to Lincoln, Carey, and the American nationalists. Henry C.K. Liu distinguishes the two systems like this. A national bank serves the nation and its people. A central bank serves private international finance. In 1995, a central bank law was passed in China, granting central bank status to the People's Bank of China, shifting the People's Bank away from its previous role as a national bank. But Professor Liu says the shift was in name more than in form. Quote, "It is safe to say that the People's Bank still follows the policy directives of the Chinese government, unlike the Fed, which has an arm's-length relationship with the U.S. Treasury. The People's Bank manages the state treasury as its fiscal agent. Recent Chinese policy has shifted back in populist directions to provide affirmative financial assistance to the poor and the undeveloped rural and interior regions, and to reverse blatant income disparity and economic and regional imbalances. It can be anticipated that this policy shift will raise questions in the capitalist West of the political independence of the People's Bank. Western neoliberals will be predictably critical of the People's Bank for directing money to where the country needs it most, rather than to that part of the economy where bank profit would be highest." If you are just tuning in, this is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Now back to Chinese banking. Besides its populist banking system, China is distinguished by keeping itself free of the debt of the International Monetary Fund and the international banking cartel, and also by refusing to let its currency float, a policy that has fended off the currency manipulations of international speculators. The value of the renminbi is kept pegged to the dollar, and unlike Mexico in the 1990s, China has such a huge store of dollar reserves that it is impervious to the assaults of speculators. In 2005, China succumbed to Western pressure and agreed to a managed float, letting the renminbi trade in a narrow trading band, but it continued to be linked to its dollar counterpart, and the government retained control of its value. Now, what's the secret mystery of Chinese productivity? In the 18th century, Benjamin Franklin surprised his British listeners with tales of the booming economy in the American colonies, something he credited to the new paper fiat money issued debt-free by provincial governments. In May 2005, an article titled "The Mystery of Mr. Wu," Greg Griot gave a modern-day variant of this story involving a recent visit to China. He said he and a companion named Karim had interviewed a retired architect named Mr. Wu on his standard of living. Mr. Wu was asked through an interpreter, "How has your standard of living changed in the last 2 decades? The interpreter responded, 13 years ago, his pension was 250 yuan a month, now it's 2,500 yuan. He recently had a cash offer to buy his home for $300,000, which he's lived in for 50 years. Karim remarked to his companion, "Greg, something doesn't add up here. His pension shot up 900% in 13 years, while inflation snoozed at 2 to 5% per annum. How could the government pay him that much more in such a short period of time?" Griot commented, quote, "The more you look around, the more you notice that no one seems to know or care how so many people can produce so much so cheaply and sell it below production cost. How does the Chinese miracle work? Are the Chinese playing with economic fire? All over Beijing, you find people selling things for less than they must have cost to make." Karim and I looked over the books of a Chinese steel company. Its year-over-year gross sales increased at a fine, steady clip. But despite the increasing sales, its debt ascended a bit faster than its sales. So its net profit slowly dwindled over time, but it also looked like the company never pays down its debt. If the Chinese aren't paying their debts, is there any limit to the amount of money the banks can lend? Just who are these banks anyway? Could this be the key? In the land of the world's greatest capitalists, meaning China, there's one business that isn't even remotely governed by free markets: the banks. In the simplest terms, the banks and the government are one and the same. Like modern American banks, the Chinese banks, read the Chinese government, freely loan money to fledgling and huge established businesses alike. But unlike modern American banks, most of them anyway, the Chinese banks don't expect businesses to pay back the money lent to them. End quote. Evidently, the secret of Chinese national banking is that the government banks are not balancing their books. Griot concluded that it was a dangerous game. Quote, "Even if it's a deliberate policy, an economy can't be deliberately inefficient in allocating capital. Things cost money. They cannot typically cost less than the value of the raw materials to make them. The whole cannot be worth less than the sum of the parts. Some laws of economics can be bent but not broken, at least not without consequences." End quote. Benjamin Franklin's English listeners would no doubt have said the same thing about the innovative monetary scheme of the American colonies. Or could Professor Liu be right? our entire economic world view may need to be reordered, just as physics was reordered when we realized that the Earth is not stationary and is not the center of the universe. When all Chinese businesses were state-owned, costs were calculated and the money was issued to pay them. Money was basically just an accounting tool, a device to keep track of what had been paid. The whole system was non-profit, since profits returned to the state. As private profits were introduced, these grants became loans that had to be paid back, but if some weren't, the state-owned banks could afford to carry a few bad debts on their books. Compare the U.S. government, which carries trillions of dollars in federal debt that nobody expects to be repaid. Before 1981, the Chinese government had no federal debt. It could print the money it needed, and it did not have to go into debt. But when it opened to Western trade, it made a show of conforming to Western practices. Advances of credit intended for national development were recharacterized as non-performing loans, rather like the English tallies that were recharacterized as unfunded debt at the end of the 17th century. So China does have a federal debt today, but it remains substantially smaller than that of the United States. In both China and the United States, money is going out that isn't getting paid back. But the Chinese mechanism may be more efficient because it does a better job of recycling the money. More of the new money from Chinese loans goes into the pockets of laborers, increasing their wages and pensions, giving them more money for producing and purchasing goods. In the 21st century America, by contrast, the economy keeps growing mainly from money making money. The proceeds go into the pockets of investors who already have more than they can spend on consumer goods. American tax relief also tends to go to these non-producing investors, while American workers are heavily taxed. Meanwhile, the Chinese government has cut the taxes paid by the workers and raised their salaries in an effort to encourage more spending on cars and household appliances. And in 2005, the Chinese government eliminated rural taxes altogether. This is not to say that life is idyllic in China, especially for the working classes. The repression of human rights deserves serious censure, and the push to westernize has imposed hardships on the poor. In response to the Asian crisis of 1998, Premier Zhu Rongji made drastic cuts in government, including the privatization of many state-owned enterprises, housing, medical care, and higher education. Privatization led to a speculative bubble in real estate, driving prices up. Many Chinese now complain that they cannot afford housing, medical care, or university education. Some are looking back fondly to the era of the Mao, despite its bloody cultural revolution, because at least their daily needs were provided for. These provisos aside, something in the Chinese economy is clearly working, and to the extent that it is their self-contained monetary policy, the Chinese may have the 19th century American nationalists to thank through their student, Dr. Sun Yat-sen. If you are just tuning in, this is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Now, there is another blow to the quantity theory of money. In March 2006, the People's Bank of China reported that its M2 money supply had increased by a whopping 18.8% from a year earlier. Under classical economic theory, this explosive growth should have crippled the economy with out-of-control price inflation. But it didn't. By early 2007, price inflation in China was running at only 2 to 3%. In 2006, China pushed past France and Great Britain to become the world's fourth largest economy, with domestic retail sales boosted by 13% and industrial production by 16.6%. As I discussed earlier, China has managed to keep the prices of its products low for thousands of years, although its money supply has continually been flooded with new currency that has poured in to pay for its cheap products. The economic mystery of China may be explained by the Keynesian observation that when workers and raw materials are available to increase productivity, adding money, demand, does not increase prices. It increases goods and services. Supply keeps up with demand, leaving prices unaffected. We've seen that the usual trigger of hyperinflation is not a freely flowing money supply, but its sudden devaluation of the currency induced by speculation in the currency market. Dr. Liu, writing in 2004, warned that while China had resisted opening its currency to speculation, it was engaged in a dangerous flirtation with foreign investors who were continually leaning on it to bring its policies in line with the West. China was hoping to reap the euphoria of market fundamentalism without succumbing to the narcotic addiction. But every addict begins with the confidence that he or she can handle the drug without falling into addiction. Liu wrote, quote, "After 2.5 decades of economic reform toward neoliberal market economy, China is still unable to accomplish in economic reconstruction what Nazi Germany managed in 4 years after coming to power, that is, full employment with a vibrant economy financed with sovereign credit without the need to export, which would challenge that of Britain, then the superpower. This is because China made the mistake of relying on foreign investment instead of using its own sovereign credit. The penalty for China is that it has to export the resultant wealth to pay for the foreign capital it did not need in the first place." End quote. Liu's proposed solution to the international debt crisis is what he calls sovereign credit and Henry Carey called national credit. Sovereign nations should pay their debts in their own currencies issued by their own governments. Liu observed, quote, "Sovereign debts in local currency usually do not carry any default risk, since the issuing government has the authority to issue money in domestic currency to repay its domestic debts. Sovereign debts' default risks are exclusively linked to foreign currency debts and their impact on currency exchange rates. For this reason, any government that takes on foreign debt is recklessly exposing its economy to unnecessary risk from external sources." End quote. The issuing government may, as Liu says, have the authority to issue money in domestic currency to repay its domestic debts, but in the United States today, newly created dollars are not issued by the U.S. Treasury. They originate with the privately owned Federal Reserve or private commercial banks, which create the money in the form of loans. Like those governments that take on foreign debt, the U.S. government will not be able to cure its mounting debt crisis under the current system. The only way out may be the sort of Copernican revolution envisioned by Professor Liu, a Chinese-American economist with his feet in two worlds. Now, although China has been flirting with foreign capital investment, it has so far managed to retain the power to issue its own national currency. It has reportedly been using that sovereign power to print up renminbi and exchange them with Chinese companies for U.S. dollars, which are then used to buy U.S. securities, U.S. technology, and oil. Washington can hardly complain because the Chinese have been instrumental in helping the U.S. government bankroll its debt. The Japanese have also engaged in these maneuvers, evidently with U.S. encouragement. The problem with funding U.S. deficit spending with fiat money issued by foreign central banks is the leverage this affords American competitors. As was observed in a January 2005 Asia Times article, all Beijing has to do is to mention the possibility of a sell order going down the wires. It would devastate the U.S. economy more than a nuclear strike. If someone is going to be buying U.S. securities with money created with accounting entries, it should be the U.S. government itself. Why this would actually be less inflationary than what is going on, we will look at later. But ironically, the dragon has risen to challenge the eagle's hegemony by adopting a monetary scheme that was made in America. For the United States to get back the chips it has lost in the global casino, it may need to return to its roots and adopt the financial cornerstone the builders rejected. It may need to do this for another reason. Its debt-ridden economy is on the brink of collapse. Like for Lincoln in the 1860s, the only way out may be the greenback solution. We'll take this up later on after we consider another interesting Asian phenomenon. Now we'll look at recovering the jewel of the British Empire, a people's movement takes back India. India is a second sleeping giant that is shaking off its ancient slumber. Once called the jewel in the crown of the British Empire, it was the very symbol of imperialism. Today, China and India together are called the twin engines of economic growth for the 21st century. Combined, they represent 2/5 of the world's population. Mahatma Gandhi unleashed the collective power of the Indian people in the 1940s when he helped bring about the country's independence by leading a mass non-violent resistance movement against the British. India celebrated its freedom in 1947. But in the next half century, the entrenched money interest managed to regain their dominance by other means. According to a PBS documentary called Commanding Heights, in the 1950s, India was a mecca for economists who poured in from all over the world to advise the Indian government on how to set up the model economy. Their advice was generally that it should have a state-led model of industrial growth in which the public or government sector would occupy the commanding heights of the economy. Gandhi's economic idea was a simple India of self-sufficient villages, but Pandit Nehru, the country's first prime minister, wanted to industrialize and combine British parliamentary democracy with Soviet-style central planning. In the prototype that resulted, all areas of heavy industry, steel, coal, machine tools, capital goods, were government-owned. But India added a democratically elected government with a parliament and a prime minister. The country became the model of economic development for newly independent nations everywhere, the leader for the third world in planning, government ownership, and control. Helping to shape the economics of Nehru and his successor, Indira Gandhi, in the 1960s, was celebrated American economist John Kenneth Galbraith, who was appointed ambassador to India by President John F. Kennedy. Galbraith believed that the government had an active role to play in stimulating the economy through public spending. He wrote and advised on public sector institutions and recommended the nationalization of banks, airlines, and other industries. India's banks were nationalized in 1969. Disillusionment with the promise of Indian independence set in, however, as the private interests that had controlled colonial India continued to pull the strings of the new Indian state. In 1973, the country had a positive trade balance, but that was before OPEC entered into an agreement to sell oil only in U.S. dollars. In 1974, the price of oil suddenly quadrupled. India had total foreign exchange reserves of only $629 million to pay an annual oil import bill of $1,240 million, almost double its available reserves. It therefore had to get U.S. dollars, and to do that, it had to incur foreign debt and divert farming and other industry to products that would sell on foreign markets. And I will continue in the next show. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.